Willkommen zu Das ist Kunst. Ich bin Jumoke Ulusanmi. In dieser Ausgabe spreche ich mit Mark Seely. 2026 ist er der künstlerische Leiter der Triennale der Fotografie Hamburg. Neben seiner Tätigkeit als Professor an der University of the Arts London leitet Mark Seely das Kollektiv Autograph. Seit den 1980er Jahren unterstützt Autograph FotografInnen, die kulturellen Minderheiten in Großbritannien angehören, ihre Arbeit und damit ihre Perspektive auf Gesellschaft sichtbar zu machen. Für die Triennale der Fotografie Hamburg hat Mark Seely unter dem Motto Alliance, Infinity, Love, in the Face of the Other eine Auswahl künstlerischer Positionen zusammengestellt, die unterschiedliche Einblicke in soziale und kulturelle Realitäten ermöglichen und dabei an das Verantwortungsgefühl und die Solidarität untereinander appellieren.
I can't see a moment in time where we collectively, as human subjects across the planet, can't be asking ourselves almost every day, what can we do better in relation to who we are and how we relate to each other.
Im Gespräch erzählt Mark Seely, wie er eher unverhofft Textildesigner wurde, warum die Musik sein politisches Bewusstsein geprägt hat und welche DenkerInnen seine künstlerische Arbeit beeinflussen. Das Gespräch haben wir auf Englisch geführt. Wenn es euch gefällt, dann freuen wir uns natürlich, wenn ihr unseren Podcast Das ist Kunst weiterempfehlt.
I know you've been working on questions on representation and visibility for many years. And I wanted to ask you as a first question, do you remember a specific moment or image when you first realized that something was missing in your life maybe, or that you wanted to work with images or with photographs?
That's a really interesting question. I think it's not like a specific image. I think it's more about an atmosphere. I think so. I'm born in, 1960. I'm 16 in 76. It's a very particular time. Punk is arriving. You know, Thatcher's about to become elected. There's a growing sense that you're not, that you're an outsider in some shape or form. I also grew up in the northeast of England, and well, first of all in London, in Hackney, in a very kind of multicultural area, and then at the age of 9 was kind of relocated for whatever reason into a very white industrial working class area. So I guess the lens of the self, the sense of being this other, you know, mixed race, black British subject, whatever that means, was part of the coming of age, really, the sense of awareness in a political climate that was, that sense of ridicule or racism, or, you know, this was my world. This was the atmosphere that I was, breathing. And I think the visual side of that, through the caricatures on TV, through watching, you know, ridiculous films that were historicizing or savage or making the black subject, you know, savage or othered or beyond human. So it's not one moment. It's about growing up in a place, really, and thinking about the micro, the macro in terms of cinema, you know, and then thinking about how, where does one sit within that, knowing full well that there's a lens on you rather than me seeing something.
Was it an artist or an image you saw which kind of spoke to you and made it like clear for you where you wanted to go in some kind of direction, maybe?
I think it's interesting that it was probably more musical for me as a kid. You know, it was more...
What kind of music?
Well, I mean, understanding the impact of, say, someone like Bob Marley was like, you know, I mean, imagine 12, 13, 14 years old and, seeing musicians on the TV, people like, and radical stuff, bands like Steel Pulse, who are my age, right, performing radical lyrics, you know, and then on the other side of that kind of that transgressive space through people like, you know, David Bowie, and there's a sense of just growing up in that in a world that is kind of colliding, a kind of kaleidoscopic sense, moving between both spaces, both black and white, you know, and I think that kind of dual heritage thing is. It has its kind of wonderful complexities, and at the same time, often you're pulled into spaces and places that you maybe do or don't understand or instinctively want to move towards. So, you know, as a young kid, I'm not walking around galleries. I'm not, you know, I'm reading newspapers maybe. I'm seeing headlines. I'm watching the news. I'm watching, at that time in the UK, there's, you know, live footage from Vietnam. There's the, you know, Palestinian Liberation Organization. There's, you know, Beirut conflict. There's Iran. There's all, it's really interesting because it's, the resonance is here. It's still living in this unfinished conversation, as my colleague and mentor Stuart Hall would say. So you're in this atmosphere, you're breathing this political space, and somehow you're in it, and the impact of you, the impact on you is can be quite profound. And moments where you like think, okay, what do I do with this? Where do I fit within this? Where do I fit within this schema of things? So I don't come from a family of shipyard workers. So there's no way into there because this is a unionized space where fathers, sons, brothers, uncles, families work in space. Mm-hmm. I'm leaving school at the age of 16 because it's an education system that's completely flawed. I take a couple of years out working as a laborer, understanding what it means to be young and finding work. And then there's a reset moment at about the age of 18 where you think, I actually need to go to school, instinctively need to get back into education. Mm-hmm. I need to think this stuff through. And, you know, through one or two really brilliant art school teachers, literally, they say, you can do this. And it's like, you think I can? Yeah, you can do it. So lucky paths, really. I mean, I'm talking A-level, which is undergraduate, and then something called foundation course, where you do this rotation of things.
Yeah.
And then I move into, you know, thinking that actually some way there's a route to university here. And maybe, just maybe, art school could be the place where I carry on thinking.
That's interesting that you thought of thinking in art school. So what was your medium when you entered? What was the idea?
I was quite combative as a young guy, and I had an argument with a fine art tutor over his behavior, which I'm quite proud of in retrospect. And then I was told by this guy that there's no way you're going to do fine art, not on my watch, because I called him out for, I think, quite obviously, you know, bad behavior on students, women students in particular. So I had to make a course correction, and it's all about people and time and places. And I did a degree in textiles at Goldsmiths.
Ah, okay.
So, which was great.
Wow.
So through textiles, it meant that I was at Goldsmiths in London in the 80s in an incredibly vibrant cohort of lecturers, people like Surat Maharaj, people like Glenn Baxter. It was like the height of Mary Kelly, amazing artists. And somehow I was in dialogue with these people in a canteen, you know, talking about the world and what could be being taught, which was brilliant.
Through textile.
Through doing this degree in textiles, which actually sailed very close to fine art. And it was through textiles that I started printing, fine art, you know, screen printing.
Yeah.
It's through screen printing that I'm beginning to take photographs and then begin to look at what images can do. And through that's the relational part into thinking about reproduction media was through screen printing and textiles.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's a kind of really strange route through. But it's all to do with navigating the barriers or understanding the points of access or being light on one's foot to think about the routes that you might be able to take if the doors get shut very quickly and you're seen as a kind of potential threat by calling things out or trying to understand things differently or being difficult, let's say.
Well, would you say that you kept being difficult?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the journey, really. I pause on that because it's not about being difficult. It's about, what's the word? It's about trying to have a different conversation. And if you're trying to have a different conversation, then you have to be in a place where people are prepared to listen. And if people aren't prepared to listen, then tensions rise. And if you're trying to, you know, create a space where your world becomes as equally important as somebody else's world, i.e. degrees of equality and respect. So I'm growing in ideas in this at this time. This is all, you know, you're absorbing the stuff, you're seeing the stuff, you're learning the stuff. You know, you're a young person whose brain is sponging as much of the conversations, you know, as you can get. And you're trying to have, you're saying no, and you're saying yes, and you're saying maybe, and you're saying, well, it could be. You're endorsing stuff. You're historicizing, and you're thinking about the contemporary. You're thinking about the moment. And then you're wondering, well, where do you go? And the best part about being back in London was that I was back in a space which was incredibly multicultural. I was in Southeast London, and you didn't feel as though that you were isolated in that conversation.
So that was in the mid-80s, I guess.
I arrived in 1982, so early 80s.
Early 80s.
Back to London.
Yes. And then you kind of found your peers.
You find your peers, and peers are great because you argue with your peers, you contest, you know, it's choppy waters always. I think you know what I mean. Thinking about creative processes, political, you know, work, trying to have a voice, trying to have agency, and then trying to map it out to be somewhere which is quite inclusive, if you like, or embracing. You know, you're learning about Fanon, for example, and you're reading Stuart Hall in real time. Mm-hmm. You've got Paul. For me, we were very lucky. We had people like Paul Gilroy. You know, his work around There Ain't No Black in the Union Jack. Seminal writing. I mean, you could not read that, right?
Yeah.
If you were thinking about work, we have people like Cobbett and Mercer, we have people like Lola Young writing, you know, incredible stuff about the black presence in cinema. All of a sudden, all these little things which you were sitting on the sofa at home with, wondering why you're feeling agitated about, people were beginning to find the language for.
And it made sense.
And communication studies and sociology and class and race and gender and, you know, power and Gramsci and, you know, Marxism. These are all like, how do you absorb all of that? The public sector in some senses responds to that, because that's what great film by Horace Ove called Pressure. That's what the pressure builds on. It created this space for change to happen, and it will always happen because change will be there. And I think part of the ongoing contestations around, you know, culture is that, you know, they, people imagine that culture stays the same. They want it to be the same, but it never is going to be the same. And unless you're open to understanding that that's what culture is, it's a fluid thing. Then you're always going to feel disappointed or feel as though something's been taken away from you.
So you just mentioned like a row of intellectual fathers and mothers.
Sorry, I didn't mean to do that.
No, that's fine, that's fine. But that's what I wanted to ask. How important are theoretical references to your work? And you just answered that.
Well, I think I think the best theoretical work is the kind of writing that anybody can really get their head around. I think the problem sometimes with the academy is language. And I think one of the reasons why someone like Professor Stuart Hall, writing in the, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, and the prolific output that he had, it often in collaboration with people,
With you also, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I worked with Stuart. I don't really like talking about, you know, but we worked together for a very long time, nearly two decades through just sharing time and talking and thinking.
How did you
through
meet?
I think in those days you could go to a conference, you could wait in line somehow, somewhere. You could be in a bar, maybe at the ICA. There was a conference, I think, at the ICA around black identity. Stuart was speaking and was prolific. And in those days, you could say, love to talk to you more. And people were generous and say, happy to do that. And if you were, telephone numbers were given. And in those days, people picked it up and a conversation would begin. Mm-hmm. People were somehow, mobility was different and people were just much more accessible. I mean, Stuart was an academic. He was used to talking to young people all day long. He's a long-established educator and incredibly generous around his time in those spaces. So if a kid turns up and says, hey, I'd love to talk to you, and they feel as the conversation is potential, then of course. And then, of course, Stuart became the chairperson of Autograph in 1991. He did launch it in 1988 at the Photographers Gallery. So there was a sense of, like, we were going to be
working together anyway,
because yeah. I needed Stuart's kind of leverage, if anything, his sense of presence, his advocacy, his ambassadorial work, his way of building community.
So at that time, you were a young photographer.
I was making my own art using probably multimedia stuff, whether it's fabrics, textiles, embroidery, right. prints, sculptural things, moving more and more towards photography. But I've never called myself a photographer.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Never, no. I mean, I come from a kind of... I curated my first show in 1995. Somehow I managed to find some way of getting some money from the state. Somehow I found some way of organizing the artists and putting them on the wall. Somehow I found a way of, you know, the invite card, the space, the place and the time. So there was a kind of hands-on DIY curatorial journey and understanding how to begin to understand how to unlock the public sector funding resources. That's an art in itself.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. That's a big vocation. So somehow from the DIY perspective, mm-hmm. you found yourself at the Triennale in Hamburg.
Yeah, I mean, 35 years later?
Yeah, 35 years later.
Takes time, right?
Well, but maybe looking backwards, it all makes sense, no? It all pays into what you've done before. Would you say that?
Yeah, I mean, things take time, you know. I mean, the culture game is very slow. I mean, I think one of the things that being a bit older teaches you is that things do actually take time. There are people that get elevated into positions of authority really, really quickly, and maybe that's a good thing, and sometimes maybe it's not such a good thing. I think the journey to Hamburg, let's say, has been difficult. It's been a lot of work from building buildings to, you know, creating shows around the world to having conversations as far afield as, you know, places like Bangladesh, South Africa, Mali, you know, Australia, wherever. You know, it's been a long conversation, a long dialogue. And I think that's okay, because personally, I think if you're going to be working on something as important as this within the city, it's a triennial, a triennale. It's every 3 years. It's a moment of engagement and investment across the city and wider European conversations. So I think we need to be in a place where there's a degree of confidence with what we're trying to say.
What is the challenge for you to being an artistic director of this big exhibition, which takes place at so many different spaces?
Do you know what? I think challenge is maybe the wrong word. It's always, I mean, there's logistical challenges. Of course there is. I mean, they're always there. We can talk about funding. We can talk about places and spaces. But what once the will is there, once the kind of sense of community is there, so the key is building that sense of community, and then you build that sense of trust.
How do you build that?
I think by being quite open and being quite straight and trying to have a conversation that enables people to feel as though that they're empowered at whatever level. And listening. I mean, look, I come into Hamburg. I'm working through, you know, two or three specific lenses, conduits, let's call them, pathways to do things, and trusting that people want to work with you. And I think overall, I mean, collectively, you know, you have an artistic director, let's put it this way, and it's a great privilege, but then you can't direct anything unless you've got a really good band. So it's like, if you're going to be a conductor, you really do rely on your solo players. But at the same time, you want to make sure that there's that the orchestra is working together. Mm-hmm. And I think that's about how you message and how you are in the space. I've never really been someone that wants to play the kind of hierarchical, you know, I'm a great curator, listen to me, everybody, I'm going to stand on the box. It's never been about that for me. And in many ways, I resist that. That mm-hmm. feels so old-fashioned, so hierarchical, so not what an inclusive I guess cultural offer is about, if it's all about, you know, people walk, they're going to say something really awful, but if it's about people walking around in Prada pretending that they're really important because they happen to be quite wealthy and have had certain privileges in life, that's not the place that I particularly want to, you know, identify with. But if it's a place as a curator that says you have a responsibility, that responsibility means that, you know, you're in a very, you know, diverse, complicated city like Hamburg, with its histories, with its spaces, with its different communities, then I would say what you can try and do in that moment is be as generous as you possibly can with the ideas and with the artists that you want to bring into the table, into that space. There will be things which people don't understand. There will be things which people identify with, which they get, which they love, which they want to celebrate. There will be things which people simply don't like. And I ask people really in that moment, through this, especially through the main exhibition at the Deichtaler, is to go into spaces, is to look at work, to look at, you know, what people are producing and saying from their various different cultural and political and historical locations, and ask yourself just to be open to that space for a short while.
So what is the idea? I mean, the Triennale has a title.
It does.
And it was really interesting because when I read that, I'm kind of brainwashed right now by Octavia Butler. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, okay. this is something I could apply to the Parable series
of
I
course.
Just read. Mm-hmm. And I thought, so what is your idea? I mean, I have this like, maybe it's not Octavia Butler, but what is it, what people can expect? Or no, maybe what is the idea? And then we can talk about what people
I think, people will always expect, hopefully, the unexpected. And that's why you go into the place of curiosity, which is what I think a cultural center or a museum or a gallery should be, a kind of place of, you know, like learning, I think, whatever level, you know, capital L learning and small L learning. So I think if I look back at what I think on a personal journey is the things that have been on my mind up front and center have been ideas of alliance. Because when you think about race, rights and representational politics, it's like, what forms of alliance can you make? If we don't have alliances, then we're caught in silos. We're simply in our lane. It's like a highway where people are, some people can drive really fast because they're in a very privileged lane. Some people can drive very, you know, moderately fast because they're in another space. And some people are just held back because they're never able to move across. Mm-hmm. So a simple act of alliance is like, you know, letting somebody through, allowing them to happen, allowing them to have a healthy life, allowing you to value what they're about. And I think on a micro level, I'm asking people to think about what they can do on a daily basis to understand and acknowledge our own humanity. On a wider political level, I'm thinking politically, you know, state to state, place to place, understanding to understanding, culture to culture. Be open to that place in terms of where we might go collectively as, you know, nation, as nation states. How receptive are we? What kind of borders do we want? Physical borders, psychological borders, you know, where is the fluidity in that? Mm-hmm. Why do we need to you know, the questions of alliance are about just, you know, either through forms of what are termed as soft power. It's like breaking that, not that it's a term that I feel particularly comfortable with, but it's breaking away all of those fears that are in place often when you're moving through spaces. So alliance for me is about fluidity and then moving to a place of understanding and acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Infinity.
Infinity is great because I don't like, you know, referencing, you know, overly scholarly work, but Emmanuel Levinas helps me understand infinity. He's a scholar that's been, you know, thinking post-World War II about our relationship to each other. So infinity is very simple. It's about this is where the Octavia Butler part might come in. It's about the infinite possibilities of humankind to become better than what we are and to understand that responsibility.
Right.
I like Infinity.
I was thinking about taking roots among the stars.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, it's like once you begin to look up and you begin to, which is why, you know, or rather than look down or look across, if you think about what are the infinite, what does infinity do to us? It gives us a space of like new beginnings, new horizons.
New possibilities. There's no
new possibilities. And I think if you've got like young people and in this time and space that where we are, you know, and, you know, older people who might be, you know, worried about where they transition to in the next, what death might be, I don't know. But if you start thinking about, you know, keeping the possibilities of, you know, of hope alive, if you like, of we can do better. I think we should always, I can't see a moment in time where we collectively, as human subjects across the planet, can't be asking ourselves almost every day, what can we do better in relation to who we are and how we relate to each other? What can we do better? And I think if you put that on the table, then I think you're in a really interesting place of feeling as though you have a civic responsibility to recognize your role in society, not to stay within a toxic place of kind of hate and othering, but to turn around and say, I will try and get you. I will try and understand you. I will, you know, make sure I get your back. I have your back. I am in a place where I can, I'm not keen on the word, but I can care for you in that sense, right? That we are, and this is a two-way street. So I'm with you and you're with me. And we're equally responsible for each other. And that's where the Levinas part comes into it, because it's all about understanding that moment of recognition where I see you first and foremost, not as an other, but as a human subject that I must embrace and take care. Because if I don't do that, and history has taught us that, and that's why Levinas is so important, is that we're doomed. I will simply be able, and probably most likely, not see you. And if I don't see you properly and fully, then you're likely to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm. So that's where the love comes in.
Then there is love.
It all leads to love.
It all leads to love. Well, it's not love in a kind of, as I've said before, and you know, many times, it's not to do with kind of Valentine's Day flowers and roses and chocolate. It's about love as a political act. It's about understanding the power of that, what that actually means to walk in a world and think, actually, you know, I'm prepared now to open myself up and say that if we don't work through the lens of love, then the other side of that is again a road to disaster. It's about hate, and that's, and love is kind of like we've introduced bell hooks into this place now. So it is about both within a familial place, the family, the relational place, the people that we might fall in love with, the role, our role again in society in that space is learning to kind of love those that might not be as fortunate as ourselves in that moment, and to build a different form of love working backwards that gives us an infinite possibility to change, that then helps us to build alliances, that build structures where people can feel as though they belong, not because they have a passport, but they belong because we're in relationships to each other all the time.
So it's a very personal question, because I read that the theme is also connected to the song Nature Boy.
Correct.
Which was very famous.
1948
mm-hmm. by Nat King Cole. And I grew up with the music from Nat King Cole because my father is a big Nat King Cole fan.
Oh, wow, okay.
And I discovered in my mid-20s that I can almost sing every Nat King Cole.
There you go.
I didn't know that because when I moved out, I was like, I never listened back to Nat King Cole. But then when I hear a song, it's like, oh, yeah, I know that song. And it was funny that I said, oh, that reminds me very much of my father.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So well, that's nice.
What role does Nat King Cole play in your life, maybe, or in relation with that topic?
A bit like you, there's a kind of unconscious presence of these kind of songs which you're drawn to, Nat King Cole, Nina Simone, things that are just in the background of your life, right? I mean, you know, the kind of the music, maybe my father was playing it, maybe not. He was actually a big country and western fan, believe it or not. He loved Jim Reeves and very popular in the Caribbean, actually, which people don't really know.
And there is also like a connection between reggae and country. That
is
not so far away. But if you tell some people, they're like, no, there's no.
There's a great, I mean, reggae and country and soul and Hendrix, you know, and the jazz side of it. There's you know, the differences are not that far apart. The rhythms are not too far apart. So, I mean, people like Nat King Cole and, you know, the Aidna Bears connection there and the Nature Boy song. I actually probably first joined the Nature Boy kind of appreciation society through George Benson's work. He did a version of it. And then it's like, well, where does this come from? Songs by, oh, it's a Nat King Cole song and this version of. So I probably went through a contemporary and then back to a historical and then fell in love with the... with the poetics of what Cole was offering. And then realizing when the song was, because one of my key areas of interest is, of course, human rights. So it's 1948. It's the year of which so many things happened. It's the year of the apartheid regime unfortunately been adopted in South Africa. It's also the year of which the Universal Declaration of Human Rights happens. It's the year of which the Nakba happens. It's the year of which the State of Israel is formed. There's so many kind of key moments around 48 as a moment of world change. It's the year of the Berlin blockade. The Cold War becomes really part of it's freezing. You know, the world is trying to offer these moments of, you know, declaration of human rights. At the same time, it's separating, it's polarizing, it's an East-West thing. And in the middle of that, there's Aidna Bears, a prototype hippie, and an African-American blues jazz singer, wonderful baritone voice. And he's singing, you know, the greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return. So you do this through hearing this song and then reading Bell Hooks and then thinking about Levinas and then thinking about, you know, all these ideas, alliance, infinity and love. And there it is, right in the heart of this moment of kind of fracture, you know, fault lines. And there's a poetic thing that emerges and is a global huge success of a record. And I sometimes wonder, that's probably something that people were reaching out for in the intimate moments of their homes. They have this black disc shellac record, little needle playing on it time and time again, this little message. And it's the first kind of crossover hit for an African-American artist to stay in the hit parade for like 8 weeks. That's a seismic cultural shift.
Yes, and so many things happened afterwards also.
Correct. Yeah.
So we talked about so many like ideas and history and theory and personal stories. What kind of images, how do you translate that into images? What kind of images do we see in the pictures?
There will be, I think... when you first enter into the Dagda Holler show, really, you're going to be confronted with the work of Rotimi Fanny Kiodi. Interesting artist. So I think this is probably one of the best examples to understand what I'm drawn to in the visual.
So he's a Nigerian artist.
He's a Nigerian artist.
What can we see? What will we see? What's so special?
What you will see is someone who's, you know, left the conflict zone, arrives in the UK, is queer, very, very living in Brixton, a very difficult time in terms of London, who's picked up the camera and is basically offering you, through this very small, intimate world that he's building, the space of, a kind of a highly constructed place of desire, ecstasy and fantasy, all made up through this performative lens, staged ideas that unpack a kind of, I think, a psychological space of hybrid Yoruba queer cultures.
Wow.
Exactly. Similar in another kind of... So this is these complexities of what I'm really interested in. I love documentary photography, and you know, the kind of those voices are very important. But in terms of the creative processes, when I talk about transgression, I'm really interested in people that are trying to, you know, work with the complexities of what we are, the work to what are clearly the kaleidoscopic conditions of our worlds, rather than, you know, black and white, mm-hmm. you know, male, female, rich, poor. You know, I'm interested in all the intersectionalities of those spaces, queerness, transgression, you know, becoming other, transformation, speaking for, adopting, becoming immersed in, diving into the unknown. And that's the bell hooks talks about being embraced by black space. So in many, let's take horror movies, like the darkness is a place of fear. Evil comes out of these black clouds and, you know, don't go into the forest. But also in the way that Bell talks about allowing blackness to kind of like embrace you, like the unknown and, you know what I mean? You know, things, mm-hmm. things that you don't know, you know, making you feel secure. That's what I'm really drawn to. Not as a curiosity, but as a place of my own sense of like wanting those non-essentialist voices to have a voice.
So that's a Nigerian artist.
Yes.
From what spaces will we see photography?
Well, again, I don't like to do the geopolitics
right.
of it all.
Okay.
But that's fine. But there will be artists, of course, from they all live somewhere and they'll be coming from somewhere. But most of them, I think, come from a kind of it's more of a kind of a place of
diaspora.
Diasporic, a kind of if there's a passport for kind of, you know, different psychologies, that's the space that I'm looking for, right?
Right.
So it's like they're people that have moved a lot or want to move a lot or are fluid around where they are. So when we talk about Derek Lynch and Matthew Thorne, you know, there's a kind of collaboration between an indigenous queer, you know, performer and a Eurocentric based, you know, Greek artist who come together in Australia and create this landscape of understanding about country, land, you know, identity, history, oral histories, and somehow, you know, produce a film that helps us understand Derek's journey more, right? So it's that kind of conversation that I'm interested in. Mario Cravanetto, you know, his father was a celebrated architect of Italian extraction, but he becomes a Yoruba priest in Brazil as a white European, impacted by the kind of global slave trade, if you like, and Yoruba influences and African cultures. And he becomes a priest of, you know, Candomblé in that moment, right? He's immersed. Why? Because of proximity and culture and shift and openness to that space.
So we're seeing historic in a way, maybe.
Yeah.
but also contemporary.
Of course, we have Inotek Stork, who's, you know, an artist who's been, you know, working. He's a Greenlander and he's that allowing all of those kind of imperial narratives between Denmark and Greenland. And yet his own community, you know, experiences to be surfaced, to be made real, to become, to journey to, I'm quoting Stuart Hall here, to journey to modernity, to allow us, these are generous moments, right? These are gifts for us to be able to see differently about those communities. Mm-hmm. They're the artists that I'm drawn to, not the observational traveler. Some of that is great work and all the rest of it, but when it really shifts is when there's a sense of a gift that we understand things much more because the door to it has been opened a bit, what's the word? It's been just pushed open a bit more for us just to get a little bit closer to that space because we will never fully understand that. But the artist as an act of generosity, the image as an act of generosity is what I'm interested in.
So he lets you peek into his...
He invites you into that space, mm-hmm. you know, whereas we know that the history of photography has got a long, you know, violent discourse, its colonialities, its ethnographic backgrounds, its anthropological treatment, its objectifying, its unnaming. When we enter into another dynamic, this for me is the future of photography, and this is the compass that I think this triannual, I'm hoping, points people towards. It's like we have to be a little bit more responsible, a little bit more collegiate, a little bit more thoughtful in what we do with the images that we produce.
So can you leave the audience alone with these images, or is there some kind of educational program you are also considering to kind of explain or guide or make people aware of specific differences?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's obviously within the, we have various partners, like 8-9 museums around the triennial. There's programs of discussion. There's, Frankie Raffles, if you like, at the Museum of Work, her work around her photography around women's rights in the 70s and 80s through her practice around misogyny and violence. There's obviously a kind of a learning moment there where you're not just left alone with the images. So the answer to that is yes and no. I mean, I think for some people, you know what I think is interesting when we encounter, music, images, cultures that we don't really understand. Sometimes, like when you look into a bright light and you close your eyes and there's an afterburn, it's the afterburn that really, like, the impression that you want to leave on folk. And then hopefully they go to those lines of inquiry either consciously, deliberately, or unconsciously. And I think part of what you offer through a curatorial encounter is, yes, there's the learning, there's the conversation, there's, you and I in conversation, and maybe you can tune in, agree or disagree, hate it, love it, hopefully not hate it if they're listening. Then it's like, where do you go to find more? Mm-hmm. What can I share across the coffee table with what I've seen and shared? What kind of learning happens? Now we're in an infinite place of learning and engagement, if you like. There's the real, there's the unreal, there's the false, there's the kind of digital universe, which is conflicting and working against some of these ideas, working for them. It's really a case of which way can you go and which way will you allow yourself to go.
Speaking of Hamburg,
yes,
because that takes place, and you're from London. I read in an interview that you said that Hamburg is also, quite a homogeneous place, mm-hmm. or that you feel like being in a museum is very, you have a certain set of people mm-hmm. going there. And
that's not unique to Hamburg, I have to say. So in context, it's like I think things are changing, though maybe things aren't. I don't know. There are pockets which you do. I'm from London. So London's, it's not Hamburg. And London's had a very different migratory kind of history than say, Hamburg has. I think, all of our museums globally have a responsibility, I think, to its various constituencies. These are civic spaces. Mm-hmm. And I think all of the citizens need to feel as though that they're represented in those spaces.
And do you have an idea of how to talk to this audiences, this potential audiences mm-hmm. here in Hamburg?
Well, it's the same issue that we've had with the work that I do at Autograph. It's about acts of generosity. You have to begin the conversation. How you begin that conversation is through invitation. And those invitations can't be just a one-off. It's about folding the it's about making sure that all the, let's just say, if we're going to deal with issues around neurodiversity, around disability, around race, around gender, around exclusion, around poverty, somewhere along the line, we can either have a theoretical conversation with ourselves, mm-hmm. those of us that are comfortable within those spaces, and say, oh dear, isn't the world horrible? How do we do it? Or we can have different acts. We can turn around and say, maybe 6:30 at night, if you want to talk about a program around childcare. I mean, 6:30 at night is probably when people are feeding their children, putting their children to bed. So why would you have a private view for an exhibition at 6:30 at night, mm-hmm. right? Why don't you just change the timeline? Why don't you make it at 4:30 at night when people can maybe come along and, bring their children after school and come to that space? And why don't you make a kind of affordable food offer in that space so that people might think, oh, my kid's hungry, I can at least get something affordable. There's lots of ways of engaging. And these are what I would call kind of, small acts of generosity, which change the way that we act as kind of cultural institutions.
So if you imagine someone leaving the Triennale mm-hmm. carrying just one image or one thought with them, what would you hope for? Would that be?
That the greatest thing that they could ever learn is just to love and be loved in return. That sense of feeling that they can embrace, that they should not be. I would like people, in all honesty, to walk away from the work that we do and feel, you know what, I can make change happen. It would be nice for them to feel empowered. So it's not empowered in a way that we feel as though they need to put their fist in the air and start screaming. It's empowered on a deeply personal way to feel confident that they can be who they want to be, that they can become the best possible version of themselves.
Thank you very much, Mike.
You're welcome. Cheers.
Der Kurator Mark Seely beschäftigt sich seit vielen Jahren damit, wie sich Fotografien auf unsere Empathie auswirken, wie sie unsere Selbstwahrnehmung bestimmen, welchen Einfluss sie auf unsere Menschlichkeit haben können. Weitere Informationen zu den Ausstellungen findet ihr in den Shownotes. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und tschüss, sagt Jumoke Olusanmi. Das ist Kunst, ist eine Produktion der Deichtorhallen Hamburg in Kooperation mit Byte FM. Redaktion: Priska Dolling, Gabriela Basso und Matthias Schönebäumer. Die Musik stammt von Alex Blanke, das Logo-Design von Gabriela Basso. Moderation und Produktion: Jumoke Olusanmi.